Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 106, Buddhism 101, Atheism and Nonviolence.
I think the early translators, who were translating Buddhism in the 19th century, a lot of them themselves were sick of the church, and they wanted to be scientific. And anybody in Europe since the 16th century or so who wasn't sick of the church was demented, mainly, because they were all burning everybody at the stake and burning witches. I mean, they were just so awful. And, frying, Giordano Bruno and Galileo had to be shut up and all this. So when they discovered Buddhism, which they did only in East Asia, because the Indians didn't even remember what Buddhism was. I was amazed. I recently discovered until 1837, the British thought that Buddha was an immigrant to India from Africa, and that he'd taught some weird thing and everybody had forgotten about it since. And that's because many statues of Buddha have like little curly things on his hair, which are actually snails. It's some legend. It isn't really hair. But then they thought he was African, and then Indian Brahmins just couldn't know anything about Buddha, although then they had Buddha was a god, They had a thing where Vishnu was Buddha, some of them. But they were completely baffled. And then the British started digging up all these huge Buddhist monuments, and they were like completely amazed that this thing had been the figure is there's 1,200, this may be a little out of date. They may have found some more since then, but about 10, 15 years ago, the figure was 1,200 major rock-cut monuments in India, of which 900 were originally made by the Buddhists, 200 by the Jains, and only 100 originally by Hindus, because the Brahmins did their rituals and they didn't have images, and then they took over many Buddhist sites eventually, and not really Jains managed to keep their sites. Since these translators were people who were against the church, they were like delighted to find in Thailand and in China and so on a religion, quote unquote, that didn't believe in God. That this really this really appealed to them, and so then they got into that Buddhism is atheistic, and then Buddhists in the modern period, I guess, to try to get along with socialism, as it swept through Asia and through everywhere. They sort of went on to, we're atheists, But actually, if you look at any picture, a painting of the Buddha's life, he's constantly interacting with the Indian gods. When he's born, Indra and Brahma are there receiving the baby, and they come and they're like Brahma was in the sutra here yesterday, talking to Shariputra. It's just that the Buddhists relativized the gods. For example, if Buddhism hangs here for a long time, then Yahweh is going to look more local on the mythical level. Do you know what I mean? Like my daughter already did when she was a little girl. I know I'm not supposed to make a long answer. I'm sorry. One Easter morning I came down, and the kids were watching TV, and apparently they had the Ten Commandments on TV. My daughter was about 11 years old, I would say. And I suddenly heard this loud shriek of glee and laughter coming in there. And she was entertaining her brothers by saying, "What? That's Mount Sinai? God lives on that dinky little hill? Didn't they take God to the Himalayas?" Which, of course, she didn't even know I was in the other room. But that was really thrilling to me. I enjoyed that. Because when I first went to Amherst, in the Department of Religion, and I was the first non-Protestant ever to be employed in that department. There was a thing that was like people in classes of things, people would mention when the word God would be pronounced in that venerable Massachusetts setting, everyone would like look nervously upward. Even if they were talking about the sociology of religion or something, the word God would be pronounced and it'd be like, everybody would be like this. So for the first 5 years I was there, I would never even use the word. I would go like, quote God, you know, use scare quotes. And actually my colleague at Smith College, a wonderful Japanese professor named Tai Uno, really very humorous, I mentioned this to him, that after some years later, we had a lot of Vietnamese boat people, more black people moved into there, more Buddhists were around, you know, it was like quite different vibration. You know? So I mentioned to him that there used to be this thing, and I didn't notice it so much anymore, and I wasn't so worried about it. He said, oh yes, I know what you mean. He said, he was at Smith College, and he said, I was here a few years before you, he said, and I used to call that the pause for thunder. It was even worse before you came. Said people would go, and then God, they go like this. You know. So the point is that the Buddhists are not atheists because they totally do believe that there are such a thing as gods, and they even believe and they talk to the beings that are cracked up to be the creator in Indian culture where they started. And when they go to Tibet or China or other places, any gods that are there, and Sri Lanka even, Thailand, what they call the Nats, you know, the local gods of the tribal gods of the people, they totally talk to them, they have rituals related to them, they deal with them, but they consider them relative beings, not necessarily enlightened beings, not Buddhas. So they're not atheistic. Really, they don't, it's just this came because they don't think that the, you know, Deuteronomy, you know, the version of creation by Deuteronomy and the notion of an omnipotent God who lives outside the universe in Protestant theology, the absolute otherness of the divine, blah, 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 one way connecting to the world not connecting to him, being a him and all alone with no misses and very grumpy, therefore. This is not, they don't believe that. And they even Brahma, and they debated with Hindus, like, how can you say that Brahma is the omnipotent creator of the universe and compassionate, and he created this mess? You know, he's responsible for it. You know? So they challenged that idea, you know, as not rational, you know. They were more scientific types. But they considered rational that gods and angels and demons and their hells and heavens and this kind of, and that there's a much larger panoply of life than just the human beings and the animals, you know. So they're, so therefore they're theistic. Then on another level, there's one other extra level. On the level of where Western mystics or theistic, monotheistic mystics, let's say, get into where, oh, we don't go crazy over this Genesis stuff, or, you know, God is particularly saying this and that and inhabiting this and that burning bush and whatever, you know. We don't go into that. We say God is the sort of, God is love, you know, God is the energy of life, God is everything. Of course, kind of pantheistic type heresy that mystics get into, what the theologians would call the pantheistic heresy. But which is definitely an idea in the monotheistic traditions where, you know, there's a oneness with the universe and that oneness is God. Right, and a human being can join with that sort of thing. On that basis, what's called the Dharmakaya of the Buddha in Mahayana Buddhism, there's the three bodies of the Buddha, usually three, sometimes two or three bodies of the Buddha. And this is the ultimate body of the Buddha is called the Dharmakaya. Kaya just means body, and in its biggest sense. And that means the body of reality. And on that level, they say that a Buddha's body is everything, like pantheistic. You know, is like Buddha's body is indivisible from our bodies, from any atom or subatomic energy or whatever one thinks the universe is. And then there's called the form body, which is indivisible, inexplicably indivisible. And within the form body, there's what's called the beatific body, Sambhogakaya, and the emanation body. And so somehow, when you are everything, if you have if you genuinely, viscerally experiencing yourself as everything, which means that you're not preferentially any particular body amongst everything, because you're everything, right? And yet you experience being everything as being a bliss within everything. the bliss that is the constitutive energy of everything. And therefore, from that sort of sense of presence, you can manifest out of any energies anything that is helpful to anyone. So on that basis, I mean, theoretically, you know, on that basis, that's why Buddhists have a tremendously hard time understanding Christians. Hindus are a little easier for them because Hindus have many avatars, you know, of the divine. But the idea that there would be one son of this omnipotent presence, you know, come at one time for one people, and anybody who didn't hang out with him was doomed to hell forever and all this kind of thing. That's just cuckoo. I mean, they can't figure that out, how people could hold such a view. And because to them, the enlightened being everything, can manifest whatever is needed. And of course, the one limitation is that since that enlightened being is not a creator, didn't create the situation of people, people mutually create it with karma, with cause and effect, with action. Karma doesn't mean fate, it just means evolutionary cause and effect. And so we're all creating it in our interactive mind field, and therefore we all have to wake up our understanding to shift it to where it produces happiness rather than suffering. Okay? So in a sense, that's very theistic, like the view that what's the real fabric of life here. If you look at your picture of reality as formed in your science classes, and mine too, for that matter, any Americans, we think that the ground, if you reduce everything, you analyze things and they dissolve under analysis, what we end up with is like a dark space, a dark void, that is nothingness, like a vast, like unlimited nothingness, a great vacuum or something. And many people, when they heard the Buddhist teaching of emptiness, they thought, or shunyata, or voidness, ah, that's the same reality we know. You know, that nothing's left when everything comes apart, you know. But from the Buddhist point of view, the state of, or the simulation of an experience of what you might imagine nothingness to be, since actually nothingness cannot be a space. It cannot be a darkness even. It's nothing, you know, neither light or dark. In fact, you know, by what we mean by the word. But anyway, there is an experience as if everything blacks out, that lies everywhere in everyone's consciousness, of course. But beneath that experience, undiscerned by the unenlightened, is what they call the clear light of the void, which is like an infinite energy, but it's an odd light. It's a gray light. It's not a bright light. You know, the hippies in the 60s is like, I saw the white light. You know, but the white light is a more superficial area of the deepest mind. There's a white light and a red light and a black light. And the deepest one is this grayish light that you, or diamond, they call diamond, or like glass or diamond transparency. But, it is bright, apparently. And I've seen it, we've all seen it, but I don't remember. Because we've all died many times from the Buddhist point of view, so every time we died, we see it. We sometimes flickers in our mind when we get knocked, pass out, or fall asleep. We can kind of come close to those layers of consciousness. But that's a realm of infinite energy, infinite abundance. And if you can be conscious on that level, rather than just sort of shoot by it as you go unconscious, then from that level, anything can be manifest. Although you wouldn't bother to manifest anything because you're just as blissful without manifesting anything, except someone else might need the manifestation who's tormented, who's suffering, who doesn't know what's going on and is freaking out. And so for that being, you manifest sort of almost automatically. So that idea that life is this plenum of bliss, void, indivisible, as they put it, or the clear light of the void, is very theistic. It's like mystical theistic. At a different level, you know what I mean? And totally would agree with like Meister Eckhart or Al-Halaj or any of the great Sufis who get there through a kind of personal vision about a god, but then get to this realm of the sort of absolute, the desert at the heart of God, I think Meister Eckhart referred to it, you know, like beyond nothingness, something like that. So when his holiness, I've been trying to deal with this holiness on this because he somehow, I mean, in his skill of dealing with Western people, dialogue, he makes a big fuss that he's non-theistic. And he once explained that. And he said, well, I want them to know right away I don't believe in God the way they do, he said. Because he said, later, if they got to know me and they even liked me, he said, and then they found out, oh, he doesn't believe in God, he said, they might faint. So I want to tell them right away I don't believe in God, he says, you know. He doesn't make like these complications like I'm making, you know. But I'm telling him that that's when, and now he wants to open up dialogue with Muslims. Lately, he started, and me too. I was summoned by the keeper of the shrines, Abdul Aziz, Abiz, Aziz, and Ziz, and Biz, to go to Madrid, and like day after tomorrow, like, they send my ticket. It was like an order, and I had to decline. But so because they want to talk to the Buddhists now, I believe, but I don't know what kind of talk it might be. So I'm telling him, if you go say, I don't believe in God right off, that's not going to put them at ease in that case. That's going to put your head on the chopping block, you know. If you go to the real traditional thing, you know, that makes you a non-human or something. You know? So if we have to, he has to think of a different term. So I said maybe non-monotheistic or something. I have to think about it. If you have a good term, please let us know. I'm sorry, I promised not to speak for half an hour. I did speak for 15 minutes. I apologize. Another question. Anybody else have a question since we're still waiting? I guess is everybody more or less here now? There's a few people, I think, a few stragglers. Anybody else have a question? So what do you think, Carol? Are Buddhists theistic or non-theistic? All those deities those Tibetans have, how can you say they're non-theistic? You know, it means they just don't believe in the Genesis story, right? That's where you, when you're talking to Westerners. But la. What does La mean? Lhasa. You know, the capital of Tibet is called Lhasa. It means the place of God. So non-theistic is not accurate, actually. But non-creator monotheistic, omnipotent creator monotheistic, yeah, that's true. And no other question? You don't dare, because I'll start talking for weeks. What? No? Oh, yes? Oh. What?
Here.
Yeah, bring him the talking stick.
So I'm going to bring this up because you kind of mentioned Jesus and like, you know, thoughts on that. And
Jesus is Buddha, yes.
Yeah, like I was raised very Catholic, and that's kind of what I was going towards. Like when I found out about the Lama reincarnation, like whole deal where they wait for a sign and then bring gifts and they choose the right gift, is that relatively accurate?
Well, that's a dimension of the Tibetan institution.
Yeah. Now, you know, when I got into Buddhism, I always thought with Jesus and the North Star and the three wise men from the East bringing him gifts. I mean, have you ever considered the maybe similarities between the Lama reincarnation rituals and, you know, in the Bible when they bring gifts to the baby who they wait for a sign and then travel from the East and they're wise men, so, you know.
There's a lot of people who have discovered, there's one insane Danish scholar who is convinced that Matthew is a translation of a Buddhist sutra, and that he thinks he can explain some metaphors in Matthew that are inexplicable in the Aramaic, and that it was actually translated from Greek originally, and originally with the Greek was translated from a Buddhist sutra. I mean, that's extreme. And then there are a lot of people, there were Buddhist precepts found in Aramaic language from the 3rd century before the Common Era, all over the Middle East, in Egypt and in Palestine, etc. So there was a common Eurasian culture, actually. The pre-Socratics, Plato had heard of the Buddhists and Buddha, and, you know, so India, the Achaemenid Empire, the Persian Empire, connected India and the Greek world, Hellenic world, from 500 BCE. So there was a lot of interaction, yeah. But exactly what it was, I don't know. But as far as Jesus goes, his Sermon on the Mount and a lot of his statements are very much in line with what many Buddhist teachers say. Like, you know, like Sermon on the Mount, love thy enemy, I don't care if you love your friends, I like to see you love your enemy, and all this kind of thing, the kind of stuff that he said, which of course the church has not paid a lot of attention to over the centuries, you know. Bomb thine enemy is how they heard it, you know. And so that's okay, you know. But the Dalai Lama is very intent upon, and I think that's a wise idea, he's very intent upon has been for over 30 years before people were frightened of religion again, as they are nowadays, saying that in the modern world we can't be converting each other. So people should study the Dharma and learn to meditate, learn to diminish their anger, learn to diminish their greed, learn to diminish their ignorance, etc. Study the nature of reality, develop their ethics and their wisdom, but keep their cultural traditions in the sense of the sort of the family religion, and don't freak grandma out running over to grandma and saying, "Grandma, God doesn't exist, you know, and he's not a yogi, so forget about it," and not do that. He doesn't like that. And he also, of course, doesn't think that they should be missionarizing madly in the other direction, and that Hindus and Muslims should be fighting, and that people should beg. He's always said people, you know, in the modern world have to beg the idea that any one religion is going to conquer all the others. It's very, very dangerous. He said that before we're starting these kind of religious fanatic things that are going on today. Okay, that's it. Any other questions? Yes, you were brought up a Hindu. What to do? No, I'm just kidding. You're getting the mic right now. Thank you, Leslie.
I've been traveling through a lot of the big disaster areas over the last 5-10 years, and I've been in a number of Buddhist countries and currently working in Myanmar, and I'm very concerned that a lot of Buddhist countries end up with so much genocide against...
End up with what?
With so much genocide and so such authoritarian regimes controlling a Buddhist population, and I'm concerned about the dialectic of having a population that embraces nonviolence without sufficient security or other mechanisms to maintain and evolve the principles throughout the society and not become victim to those that abuse that otherwise evolutionary advance.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting question. The Buddhist society, first of all, what is a Buddhist society? If we look at the Buddha's time, the Buddha was said to be, remember, a world-conquering king. He was born in the Kshatriya family, which means a warrior and royal family, or a Buddha, depending on what happened. Remember, then there's the whole story about the father trying to keep him in the household as a king. Father wanted him to conquer the world, you know. But when he broke out of that, he then founded this institution based on, you know, introducing the idea of nonviolence, you know, which the Jains were also doing at the time on a much smaller scale. And he organized really a kind of army, the monastic army. And like all of his own country suffered terribly, the Shakya kingdom, because all of the young cadets, all of the young warriors of his peers, you know, they followed him, and they found this higher way of being where they, if they died, all right, you know, they weren't going to be fighting for their country and killing other people, you know. So there's this dialectic in Buddhist history where the Buddhification, let's say, of a country moves it toward nonviolence and makes it vulnerable. But in a way, no country, therefore, is really a Buddhist country unless that process is totally complete, which is to say the military, and you see in Buddhist history this seesaw between militarism, which was what the Buddha was supposed to have done according to the canons of his culture, and monasticism or spiritualism or seeking enlightenment or whatever, but the institution that supported it was the monastic one, the idea that you'd withdraw from ordinary productive activity and sexual activity and property owning and anything, and even identity as a citizen of something, and you would just be seeking this higher form of life, so to speak, you know. Now, Burma, Cambodia, if you go to Angkor Wat, which I presume you did if you work in that area, I presume you went to Siem Reap, what is striking about Angkor Wat is where's the Buddhas? All the murals are huge wars between the Cham people and the Thai people and the Cambodian people, the Khmer people, right? These immense things, you know, and then they're doing their Ramayana, which they got from India. And even in India, which is about a war, right, a big racial war against the Sri Lankans, and of course demons, you know, but anyway, against the dark people in the south of India. And so where's the Buddhist country? Then if you see that dialectic of the demilitarization of a country, it's becoming vulnerable and thereby in a way getting submerged and lost to sight in history almost. And you see that coming down to the modern period. The two countries that are really Buddhist countries, really only the two, are the Tibetan cultural country, you know, whatever size it is and whichever, however it's divided in different times, because they more or less totally demilitarized and became totally vulnerable. And then, in one of the miracles of history, they did the same service or disservice, depending on how you see it, to the Mongolian people, who had been Genghis Khan's people. Ferocious, frightening people, very strong, you know. But not any more ferocious, actually, than anybody else, but just very strong, you know. Conquered the biggest empire in history. So, and then both of those countries or cultures or nations, whatever, got totally crushed by the product of our demonasticization in the West. And what was the great demonasticization in the West? The Reformation, where Henry VIII and company and all the German princes and the Scandinavians and the Dutch closed down all the monasteries, took all of their wealth, all of that manpower. And then what happened? What did those countries do when they were totally militarized? That is to say, no balancing monastic vocation for some people, taking a little something out of the control of the warlord types, you know. Those Northern Europeans just conquered the entire world, genocided vast numbers of people here. We're sitting on top of a genocide right here and now. Right? Did you go in the sweat lodge? All my relatives, you know, and with that, it's bubbling back up because, you know, they're still alive, you know, but very genocided. The French great historian Fernand Braudel argues, just, you know, convincingly, nicely baked, look at them, how nice, argues convincingly that European demographers calculate the number of the population of Native Americans, North and South America, at the time of the beginning of Columbian era, at 120 million. Not this crappy 15 million that the American demographers try to get away with, but 120 million. Because of the size of those mound-building cities in Mississippi, the pyramidal, you know, Tenochtitlan was like 20 times bigger than London, Paris, or Madrid, and, you know, huge, you know. And they weren't throwing people off Mel Gibson's pyramids and trampling on them, like, no way. That's a big myth made up by the conquistadores to justify their absolute destruction of those people. No big commercial center like that is going to thrive as a commercial center with huge avenues and everything. If they're grabbing everybody for hundreds of miles and throwing them off a cliff, ripping their hearts out by the thousand a day, you know, it's just complete propaganda. It's like Chinese propaganda about Tibet. And so, you know, in short, the imbalance of a society and its sort of total militarization leads to genocidal behavior. And European Americans are highly guilty of it. We're doing one in Iraq just today. We somehow can't stop our machine, unfortunately. And then you get to Cambodia. And Cambodians had become fairly gentle, but they were not a fully Buddhist in that they had their armies and things. And then you bomb them, drop more bombs on them than were dropped in all of World War II in a couple of years, you know, send the CIA in, depose their king, crush all their monks, send some guy with a PhD from Paris about creating a socialist paradise by killing everybody who wears glasses. And it gets pretty savage, you know, as we saw, you know. And although that's unusual, in Burma, the Buddhist people are being trampled by a colonialist implanted militarist monarchy, you know. And the colonialists at the moment are the Chinese, who are the ones who are maintaining. Aung San would be, Suu Kyi would be president, and that'd be fine, except the Chinese supported that. Chinese and some oil companies of ours, which are same force, kind of, between them, supported those, that supports that monarchy. I mean, those military guys. and they're genociding their own people, and they're trying to create a new capital and hide somewhere in a bubble, you know, which is really too bad. We should invite them all out to come and take over any one of the Trump Towers and all live in there and send them a lot of slaves and be happy in New York and leave their people alone. And they would crumble in a minute if China would let them go, and they would be gone in no time. They would leave. So this is why this is an interesting century that we're in the sense that we may have reached the time when the militarization is self-destructive and it can no longer help anybody. And the victor cannot enjoy the spoils any longer. There are no spoils, basically. And here I would recommend a wonderful book, not based on Buddhism whatsoever, by someone called Jonathan Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L, called The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, based on the Eastern European Revolution and on his analysis of von Clausewitz, actually, theory of war, you know, the Prussian guy, and how that theory of war shows that war now is impractical for the simple reason that in his day, the purpose of war was to defeat a rival nation's army and then get the rival nation to do what you wanted them to do, like a kind of treaty, imposing a treaty and so on. And 95% of the casualties were the enemy's army, and there was a little collateral looting and pillaging and so on sometimes, and the troops would get out of hand. But that's really what war was. And now, 95% are civilians. You wreck the entire country. Nobody's going to do what you want. They're going to get vengeance on you, live or die, suicide bomb you, forever. So you never can win. You know, you can't enjoy it. You know, there, someone will blow up your laundromat and your discotheque and your coffee shop because someone who's rendered completely desperate and freaked out by your having destroyed their whole everything, right? So if that is so, I'm just saying, so that's just, you know, that's a theory, but if it is so that we have reached a time in history where that no longer can happen, and therefore war is in fact no longer viable, then those countries that had the experience of demilitarizing themselves and choosing, if you will, vulnerability in a certain way and enjoyed it for some period of time until something crushed them, and usually another militarized society. But their skill of how to do that, how to redefine life, how to allow through understanding of the mind, management of the emotions and of ideologies, and of intellect, of emotion and intellect, management of that, providing method of management of that to individuals to manage their own, and therefore have a higher quality of life where then they were not willing to get into the paranoid thing of kill and be killed, live by the sword, die by the sword. You know, they're unwilling to do that based on the science of the situation, but the reality of the situation, that then becomes an absolutely vital survival necessity for the planet. That those cultures become really understood, really studied, really propagated, really respected. And therein lies why the Dalai Lama matters, my book. You know, because they, you know, he represents, it's not him personally, but he represents the culture, a culture that was a conquest dynasty, brutal, violent, had a huge area. The lucky thing for the neighbors were they didn't like living at lower altitudes, so they wouldn't stay. They'd just loot and pillage and rape and do all the horrible things that conquerors do and go back up to the plateau. So they didn't sit down on top of people much. I mean, a little bit in Central Asia on the Silk Route. Then a little bit in Nepal and places like that, but otherwise they didn't. And then they became totally peaceful over about a 500-600-year period. And actually, if we dug back and revised completely the understanding of Indian history, I think we would find that India also conquered its conquerors and became relatively gentle and therefore was predated upon by the Islamic, Persian, and Turkish invasions, mostly not so many Arabs, but Turks and Persians, who came in and ravaged what ancient India had been, you know, around a thousand years ago. Completely, like, they would sit down and catalog the tonnage of gold and jewels that they would take out of the temples, Hindu or Buddhist, in India, and there were thousands and tens of thousands of them, because the people there had become very also living in another dimension. Now, the other dimension, what is the other dimension? This is like basic Buddhism. I am alone, perhaps, amongst my translating colleagues nowadays, who insists on translating the word karma by the word evolution or evolutionary action. Because Buddha, ahead of Darwin, certainly understood that human beings were totally genetically related to monkeys and even every kind of animal, actually, not just monkeys. But his version of it had one key difference from the Darwinian one. It isn't just the genes that have gone from life form to life form in a random mutation sort of thing. That all goes on in its own sea of material forms, but there's a mind involved with that. And therefore, Darwin himself was a monkey from the Buddhist point of view, not as a faith thing or some mystic thing, as a biological theory. That's how biology works. We ourselves have been in all different life forms. That's our biological rule. And therefore, when we die, what the seed in our mind, that is the core anchor of our patterns of habit, which then codify into instincts, is what produces or affiliates with the next life form, right? So therefore, that's why we must live generously, not to be all like this, hunched over something. We must live gently so we're not like this, like wanting to jab something or kill something all the time. We must be open-minded and not frightened and paranoid so that we'll be able to, and we're therefore even generous to the point of being able to give ourselves and to be very open. And then we get reborn in an open form like the human form. Human form is a mammal. First of all, mammals are open relative to other animals. The other ones just drop some eggs somewhere in the sand and they take back off to the ocean. And then the eggs have to like fend for themselves when they hatch, right? But a mammal takes it right inside the belly, and then it's helpless for years, has to be like coddled and googled around for years, or they're done for. Can't get to Harvard without being googled for at least 5 years or 20 years, not to mention tuition payments. And so that therefore, one doesn't just live like you live, I live, as Americans, we have our job, savings, although not much of those with credit card, let's say most of us, job and credit card, or really should be job and savings, and family, and concern for their future, and pension, then long-term health care, and then a plot in Fairlawn Cemetery, or some other such thing, you know. And then that's the extent of our concern, because we think that's reality, because there's nothing that's going to go on beyond that. Children will, yes, and we can be humane and humanistic and hope for the best that our children inheriting this like totally overpopulated and polluted and destroyed planet are going to manage somehow with, as what Ronald Reagan said, sunblock 2000 and deep sunglasses, you know, with the ozone layer depleted planet or whatever, you know, never mind. So my point is that we're, however, après moi le déluge. Therefore, on some level, we are the après moi le déluge culture. You know, let the flood come after me. And that's why we're not really caring for the planet for our great-grandchildren or whatever. We're even dubious there will be a planet for them, basically, as a society. You know? I mean, not that we're not trying to be ethical and humane and moral within our circle, but it doesn't extend far, very far, because finally we're out of it. And that's all meaningless anyway and so on. So the Buddhist reality theory is very different. We're going to be back. Our relations with others, you kill an enemy on the battlefield, and next life he kills you. You don't get rid of him by killing him. You don't get him out of the universe. So therefore, you don't kill. Actually, if you get killed, then as long as you don't get mad about it, you're going to be reborn well. So, of course, it's hard for any even Buddhists to live up to that, but great many did. One of the things that I really like is there are these former life stories of the Buddha, in which he does, in the ones that are involved in developing generosity, he gives his life and his blood and his head and his eyeballs and everything, wife, children, if it's a culture where you sort of, they're your own property, kingdom, everything he gives, again and again and again, you know. And when they tell those stories, which are sort of the narratives that form people's ethical views in those cultures, they say, don't try this at home. You know, don't feed yourself to the first tiger you meet. Don't jump in front of the train or the starving caravan if you're an elephant. You know, don't do this. because you can make, as a human, you know, you might do more with your life and develop yourself and evolve in it more than just by the one act of generosity. And if you lose your life, if you push yourself beyond the where you've reached in consciousness, you'll regret it and it'll backfire. It won't work, you know. You have to be in a rational causal flow type of thing. Now, the fact that they put a warning like that, don't try to do this, indicates to me that people in the society would be genuinely moved and inspired by these amazing stories. Like my Sanskrit teacher, he completely always freaked out. He was quite fond of me, and he just thought I was doomed. He kept saying, "How could you study that Buddhism, Bob? How could you read that?" He said, "Go back to the Vedas where they have good war songs." He says, "Those Buddhists are such a bunch of damn goody-goodies. How can you stand it?" He says. And I said, "Well, Dan, you know, I can see how you can feel that way, but, you know, if you were dealing with someone, you would rather have people be goody-goody to you, wouldn't you?" "Well, I suppose so." You know. But, you know, he couldn't take it. So I think Buddhist societies are much less prone to genocide than other societies. They might be more prone to being genocided in a context where genocidal militarism is flourishing. But, and therefore, you know, we've seen them come and go in history, and therefore we've lost the lesson of them. But in the modern time, you know, genocidal militarism is genociding itself. So whether it's the cleverness of God, Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Krishna, whoever it is, Einstein, we're in a new world now, which is totally interconnected and totally different. And one person's mind can resonate and destroy millions and billions of people. And so, the you know, Al Gore's book like that was a truly great thing, The Earth in the Balance. I don't know if you ever read it, but he was talking about this threshold where the human being suddenly realized their power, that they could actually wreck their planet. You know, which before is just, it's always there, it's Mother Nature. You just throw the crap in it and grab it out of it. And economics, the dismal science, doesn't even put it on the books. The resources are just zero sum. Like, yeah, they don't cost anything, and the disposal of waste doesn't cost anything. And then you're making GDP and everything and doing all this great stuff while you're trashing the resources and trashing the environment. And they're not paying for any of that, you know, in your cost calculations, right? And destroying yourself, in fact, and your children. So, I don't know, that was a long answer. But that puts us in a situation today which is very dangerous and yet very hopeful. And, you know, what's happened the last 8 years in our country is, in that sense, is like horrendous. It's incredible. But in a way, maybe that silly fellow, that silly Yaley, or like fake Yaley, he could never have even gotten into Yale. It wasn't for the legacy thing. But anyway, that he might have been, really what he's doing is blowing the cover of a certain elite, actually, by being such an idiot. Uh-huh. And they've really been behaving like that for a longer time. And so maybe it's a way of us finally getting so sick of it, we don't allow it to go on anymore. And our students, for example, becoming a bit more like the Korean students. If our American students were like the Koreans, they never would have gotten into that White House, those lunatics. They would have gone down to Florida and torn the whole town apart. You know, have you ever seen the Koreans have a demonstration? Ooh. Okay, so tonight, oh yeah, back to Vimalakirti. Oh yeah, I was. Now you're all here. Today is the Dalai Lama, tomorrow is the Dalai Lama's birthday. So in a way, it's nice that we talked about it. In a way, I'm talking about my book. I didn't intend to, but you got me into it. And the thesis of my book is what I tried to do in the book. You know, if you go around in the Tibet world, and people are going free Tibet, this and that, but actually, if you ask them, do you think Tibet can be free? Will it be free? And they all say no. They say, oh, no, it never happened. Never get China out of there. It's hopeless, impossible. You know, people, everyone is despaired, in short. Nothing will ever go right. It's kind of our excuse for why we don't push harder to make it go right. We all say won't work anyway, so why should I really make an effort? And so in the case of the Tibetans and the Chinese, I wanted to show, And one of the things they say about the Chinese is that the Chinese can never change in their way of treating the Tibetans and really take pride in the Tibetans and sustain them and release them and generally support them instead of crushing them and genociding them. Because it would be too hard for them. It would be a terrible loss of face. They would lose Tibet. They would lose everything, you know, lose this great resources of Tibet, and they would just be embarrassed, and it would be just mortifying for them. They could never do it. So my book shows the way of how they could do it and how, if they did, they would gain everything that they want, actually. Not only would the Tibetans be free, but the Chinese would gain. And everyone is a little shocked with my book, but they kind of smile. I'm not sure why. They haven't committed me yet. But the idea that you could, if Hu Jintao could become friendly with the Dalai Lama, like everybody else is, more or less. All the world leaders are more or less friendly with the Dalai Lama. I mean, they don't do what he wants them to do because they want to make money with China or they're scared of China. But they think this China can't deal with it. But they like him, you know, and all the people like him. Look at all these demonstrations, and especially love the Italians. During the whole thing in March, the Italians were parading around Rome with a huge sign saying, Siamo tutti Tibetani, and carrying that in front of the Chinese embassy and everything, which means that we are all Tibetans, which is true, you know, in the sense that we're all one body of life on this planet, you know, and they're the ones being beaten in that case. I mean, we're all Darfurians, too. We're all Burmese. We're all lots of other people as well. But in that context, we're all Tibetans. I really like that. Good for the Italians. So anyway, I show that Hu Jintao could get himself a Nobel Peace Prize. And that's not unrealistic. People, when they read it, they realize that's not unrealistic. He could definitely get, if they, you know, like they plan, let's do the Olympics. We'll get a lot of this and that, and then we'll be all respected everywhere, and everybody will love us because we did Olympics. We won lots of gold medals. It's not really working out. But then, well, we'd be nice to our neighbors, and we'd be nice to the Dalai Lama, and then everybody would love us. Yeah, that would work out. And they're not, you know, the being not nice is not getting them anywhere, actually. It's going to get them an empty, ruined, high plateau. So that was my birthday present for the Dalai Lama, actually. Is writing the book. I didn't intend to write that book. I wanted to write a book for Menla on Tibetan medicine. And really, because I was forced to study Tibetan medicine when I was a young monk by my Mongolian guru. Don't mess with Mongolian guru. I wanted to meditate and realize shunyata and attain enlightenment. And he said, no, you study medicine. Never mind about enlightenment. That'll be later. It was really great. Geshe Wangyal, Denji Lede Tenimete, fantastic person. And so, you know, and this Tibet House's mission is to preserve Tibetan culture. And Tibet, a real metric of Tibetan culture is the medicine. You know, all those paintings, you see them on the wall. I don't know if you stop to look at them. It's like an exhibit. This is only half of them. There's about 80 of them, 77 or no, actually 80. And some are lost. But they're illustrations of the textbooks that you must memorize and learn and study and pass exams on to become a doctor. And they are totally amazing. I mean, we could have a whole lecture on any one of them. These ones over here are the urine analysis illustrations over here. And you can't imagine why they're totally amazing. There's the miracle urine. There's bile urine, phlegm urine, mixture urine, all different kind of things. And you just look at it and you get it, you know, smell it, taste it even, your patient's urine. And then there's this grid where those tortoises are, looks like tortoises, and those are, you put like tic-tac-toe, like chopsticks on the top of the urine bowl, and then you observe where certain patterns emerge and you can do divination. You can tell if there's some demonic affliction or if someone's doing black magic on somebody. That's called the miracle urine. It's totally amazing, actually. Something truly incredible. I used to take Tibetan doctors to hospitals, and the residents and the interns would go completely bananas when he'd start like sniffing the urine and stirring it and tasting it. Ah, they'd all be like freaking out. They'd take a little bottle and send it off to a lab somewhere and get back some numbers and figures and chemistry. And that level of contact with the patient they hadn't planned for. So therefore, that's what I planned to do. But I decided instead, I got so fed up with everybody running around, and like Tibet is hopeless. So I just want to show it isn't hopeless. I'm not saying the guy will do it. I have a joke that I'm so tired of saying myself, but some people who haven't heard it don't mind. If President Hu doesn't want a Nobel Peace Prize, we will confer it upon President whoever. That's my joke. But he would be smart to do it. I'm sort of visualizing him as the Nixon of the situation. He was very vicious with the Tibetans, and therefore he can present himself to the other members of the Politburo as a toughie, if for the bunch of paranoiacs that they are, and then he can say, but guys, we're going to get a lot more mileage, a lot more money, a lot more respect, a lot more this and that by befriending the Dalai Lama and taking these steps that he recommends. And then we'll get prizes and we can go off and we truly will have conquered the world by being respected by everyone in the world. So anyway, I wanted to show that. And I've given a copy to Henry Kissinger and to all kinds of people. We'll see what they do make out of it. What?
Did you translate it for him?
I can't hear you.
Does he read English, or did you translate the book for him? For the Dalai Lama?
No. Who? Kissinger? Kissinger reads English in a deep voice. He was a Harvard professor with his accent. What?
He didn't say
no, who? I haven't. I may have gotten it to the basic thesis of it to some of whose secretaries. Whose secretary?
Whose secretary? And he understands English. Are you going to translate that for him?
What?
In the back. Hi. Does he read English? Are you going to translate the book for him?
Yeah, someone is translating it.
For who? For him.
For who?
Yeah.
For who?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So that's that topic. And we won't get in the topic of our own country, which has no moral leverage left at all at the moment. So, although Obama might help restore a little bit of it. Yeah, they're pictures. Oh, for Bush? Yeah, I was told for Bush that I should make it put on tape so he can listen to it. He won't read it. He won't read it. Yeah, well, when he goes to the Olympics, I want him to lean over to who? To who? I want him to lean over to who and say, hey, I'll give you a gold medal too. Just be nice. Nice to the Dalai Lama fella. I'll give you a gold medal too. You can have your own gold medal. And dangle one. Cheney will be pissed off, but never mind. I'll give it. I only got a few months left. You can have your own. Why not? You don't have to worry about the Congress here. Not like me. You're a real dictator. You're a real decider. You're a real decider. I'll give you a medal. Just be nice to Dalai Lama. He has a lot of friends. So, anyway, happy birthday to the Dalai Lama. I'm going to read, maybe tomorrow morning I'll read some prayers. I'd like to find one in English for you, but it might be laborious for me to translate it, but these long life prayers of the Dalai Lama, that's what one does. One prays long life. So if you want to do something for Dalai Lama's birthday, you can say like 200 Om Tare, or 500 Om Tare, Tutare, Turi, Swahas, and maybe by the end of the evening I'll teach you that mantra. How many of you know the Tara mantra? Oh, good, not many. So anyway, if you recite that mantra and think of the white Tara, then that helps somebody have, and think of them having long life, it helps someone have long life. I wanted to talk a little bit about Vimalakirti and his meeting with Manjushri, and who finally decides to go see him. And then when he comes, he comes to his house, and then everybody follows him to the house. And then Vimalakirti's house is like Doctor Who's TARDIS. How many of you know Doctor Who? A few more. Oh, God, you guys are deprived of popular culture. Doctor Who has a thing called a TARDIS, which is a time machine. He travels around and he's a time lord, himself comes from the future. And it looks like a London police box on the outside, a blue box. But inside is a huge thing. There's like hundreds of rooms and labs and et cetera. It's enormous inside. And the Vimalakirti's house is like that. Thousands of people come to the house and they all come in to the house and they somehow fit. And he makes his house empty. And because the whole huge assembly, remember from Buddha's thing, goes over with Manjushri to talk to him. But then the minute he comes, Manjushri comes in. When Vimalakirti saw the Crown Prince Manjushri, Crown Prince of Wisdom, that is, and addressed him thus, "Manjushri, welcome, Manjushri," he says. "You are very welcome. There you are without any coming. You appear without any seeing. You are heard without any hearing." And Manjushri says, "Householder, it is as you say. Who comes, finally comes not. Who goes, finally goes not. Why? Who comes is not known to come. Who goes is not known to go. Who appears is finally not to be seen." Now, there's the whole teaching of selflessness right there. Because they go at it right away, the two of them, you know, because that's their thing. That's Manjushri, you know, is the Bodhisattva, who is the incarnation of the transcendent wisdom of all Buddhas. And he's actually a Buddha who vowed, as a Buddha, "I will be a Bodhisattva, and I will go everywhere where there are Buddhas, and I will demand that they teach about selflessness and emptiness." So I always push that, the what they call the profound vision of the nature of reality. So he can't even go into a house, the two of them, but saying, "There you are, but you're not there." So there you are, but you're not there, you see. That's like meeting someone like that. But what does that mean? That is the teaching of selflessness. And that should make it clear to you. For example, you have a nose, but you don't have a nose. Everyone, this is my favorite thing about the nose. Okay? So what I'm challenging everyone here, not one of you can find your nose when you look for it. You have a nose, right? But you can't find it. Like, yeah, she's wiggling her nose. Everybody starts wiggling their nose like a rabbit. But when you wiggle your nose like a rabbit, is your cheek also wiggling? Where's the line between the nose and the cheek? I'm saying really find the nose. You can't say, "Well, I wiggled something and that's my nose." And besides, is the muscle that wiggles the nose? Is the skin on top the nose? If you skinned your nose, would you still have a nose? Anyone will say, "Oh, there's my nose," and they'll touch something. But any plastic surgeon could make you, could fix your nose, take that piece off that you touched, and therefore it's not essential to your nose. And there's no line between the nose and the not nose. And then if you say, you get all technical and you say, "Well, there's like a million different points on my nose. They're all really on my nose, X, Y, Z. I can sort of sketch it with a computer." But a point is not there, right? A point has no size. If you make a dot, it's a small circle, right? Or a small sphere if you're in three dimensions. A point doesn't exist. Therefore, there's no point on your nose, in fact. So therefore, if you really want to find your nose, you can't. Not one of you can find your nose. And there you go. You go through life with it. I call it our hood ornament. Unless your nose is so small you can't see it. Like some Asian people, then they don't have a hood ornament. And they maybe go and have one made so they can feel like something. They too much imitate the West. But the point is, that's what he's saying. He's saying, you come without any coming. That is to say, you go without any going. Who appears is finally not seen to be there. And what that means is that, for example, you look at me and you say, "Oh, there you are, you're appearing." But I'm an unconceivable thing made of atoms and energies and whatever. There's aspects of me you can't see. And therefore, you're just seeing some image in your mind that you think is me. But if you really investigate to try to find me, you can't find anything. I dissolve under analysis. everything that we analyze to seek to find the sort of analysis proof, you know, that resist analysis, and it's really there. There it is. We can't find anything. Do you follow me? Nose is just a very graphic example. Are you convinced you can't find your nose? Has everybody got that point? You see what I'm saying? I mean, even, you know, the nose is made of atoms, right? You believe in physics, and then therefore there are these atoms, right? There's like, they say that the nucleus of the atom is like a flea in Yankee Stadium, and then the proton or whatever goes around it is like a couple other fleas or one other flea flying around in the bleachers. And so therefore the atom is mostly totally empty, a couple of fleas in there. So you go down to atoms in your nose, and they're fleeing around. Which atom is your nose? Is the empty space your nose? You know, then you go to quantum. Then they don't even know where there's an atom. It doesn't even know if it's an atom or a wave and where it is. It's in six places at once. I mean, forget about it. Nobody knows their nose. You're looking worried. Don't look worried. Point is, when you don't look for your nose, there it is. In a non-analytic, you know, unexamined, conventional way, like I'm going to say, like if you went to a plastic surgeon, he would take a computer picture of your face and put a grid over it, you know, like those old technical looking things, and then he would just draw a line and say, okay, from this side is your cheek and that's your nose. And this cartilage is your nose and that isn't, you know, I mean, it's arbitrary what we're going to call our nose, right? It's totally arbitrary. It's created by our concept, actually. And if we don't analyze it very carefully, there it is. So it doesn't know, it's like yourself was not taken away by realization of selflessness. In fact, yourself comes to life, because what you realize when you realize that you're selfless means that you are a process. You are a work in progress or a work in decline, either one. And therefore, you're responsible for shaping yourself at all times, because you're constantly being reshaped. Even physically, your cells are changing, your molecules, cosmic rays are going in and out, wireless communications are there. You know, you turn on your computer and your email is coming. That means when you don't turn on, the email is like frustratedly zapping around in your brain. Like, there's 10 emails chasing me. That's why I like, get them in the computer and get them out of the air. So the point is, they are going right to it. They're saying, Manjushri, welcome. Here you are, but I don't see you. So what he means is, I know that you're just conventionally and relationally here. There you are. But I don't try to, like, think that I really see you. You're like a reflection in a mirror. You're like a thing. But still, I am engaged with you. I'm talking to you. You're there on a relative reality level. But you're not an absolute thing there. And I'm not an absolute thing here. Right? Who goes is finally not known to go. So then suddenly, this is a way of, now that it seems surprising to you because it seems very commonsensical, actually, that we're all totally relational. That's one of the virtues of being, of the things that, you know, our sciences have discovered a little bit when they don't get dogmatic about matter, you know, materialism. But we've discovered that we are relational beings, but emotionally we don't feel that relational. When you get mad, yeah, of course you really hardly ever get mad. I get mad. When you get mad, then you go around breaking china. You break everything. You break your nose, your own nose, when you get mad enough. Dalai Lama used to laugh about the guy who helped him fix his car, that he had this Austin Miner that had been given to his predecessor that was all rusting, and he was trying to fix it up. And he had this attendant, a friend, who was helping him fix it. And then when he would skin his knuckles, turning an old rusty nut with his ply, with whatever tools they had, and it would hurt, and he would go, ow! And then he'd be mad at the car, and he'd bang his head two or three times on the bottom of the car. I used to tell him, he liked him a lot, that guy, but he had a hot temper, and he would be mad at the car when he skinned his own knuckles, and then he'd smash his head on the car. Now, what that means is that there's a place in ourselves where we think we are kind of absolute. And then when that's picked up by strong emotion, we start getting really crazy about how we relate to things, destructive and harmful. Or if we're obsessed, it can be obsession rather than anger or other kinds of addictive emotions, as they call it. and even our whole perception of ourselves as this unenlightened, suffering, ignorant being, we think is realistic, whereas it isn't, actually. The Buddha's perception of us is better than ours. Sees us as part of an ocean of bliss. We can to learn to discover that, but in order to do that, we have to see through our own, the falsely imported absoluteness of our own perceptions. And there's so many examples. Like, for example, if I drew the letter A on a blackboard here, you would see that, and it would your mind would irresistibly go A. And it would be as if the A comes out of the A. You know, that form, that shape, an A-frame with a cross piece, just has A in it. It goes A when you see it. When you drive down the highway, you see a cigarette commercial. It's, you know, Marlboro. You know, your mind reads it. Can't help it. And it's as if it's in the letters. And that's why you get freaked out. You go to China or Russia, someplace where they have a different alphabet, or it's India, and you think you're lost in a weird place. Because they don't make any noise, those letters. But actually, if you take the A and put it on its side, does it still say A? When you put it upside down, it looks, what is it? It's like a weird, like a sawhorse standing on its head. In other words, it shuts off at some point. But what that means is your mind puts it in there. Your mind projects into things and then considers those things to be absolutely what you project into them. And your mind, your deluded mind, projects into yourself an absolute status, as if you are an unquestionable thing in itself, and even the center of the world. Like here and now, each one of you is the center of the room to yourself. Aren't you? It's happening around you. You're the one who's here, as far as you know. The rest of us might be a matrix trick. You know, one of Morpheus's tricks, or an agent's tricks, right? But you know you're there, you know? And then it becomes a little, and therefore, the most important thing in the room to you is your presence, right? And that's what you have to worry about. And then there's the one thing that makes you paranoid immediately, and that is nobody else thinks you're the most important thing. Not only that, they think they're the most important thing in the room, and they think you should be agreeing with them. And this is the first truth of suffering. This is the noble truth of suffering. It's why we suffer, because we have this unrealistic relationship to the absolute us versus the absolute universe. And in that relationship, two absolutes banging into each other. And in that relationship, we are less than the universe. And therefore, we are overcome by it, and we lose. We die, we get sick, we grow old, we meet the unloved ones, we lose the loved ones. You know, he lists all many sufferings of the absolute person here versus everybody else. Do you follow me? It's pretty simple, really, actually. What is complicated, not complicated, but what requires insight and perseverance and concentration is to the thought experiment of losing your nose, letting your nose, seeing how your nose dissolves under analysis, seeing how atoms dissolve under analysis, and most deeply, seeing how the self dissolves under analysis.